Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Opel. The all-new Opel Mokka. With a new visor front face and pure panel interior, this is Opel.
Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.
Now, Katrina Crowe, who's historian and former head of special projects in the National Archives, has written an essay for the forthcoming issue of the Dublin Review. And it's an essay on the report of the Commission of Investigation into Mother and Baby Homes, which was published earlier this year. And Katrina now joins me in studio. Katrina, good morning and thanks for coming along.
Good morning,
It's a very. I read your report of the report last night. It's quite intriguing. I suppose I'm going to begin by asking you to tell me about Caroline O'Connor's testimony versus what is recorded in the report, and that forms the preamble to your essay and to your analysis.
Mm-hmm. The reason that, well, first of all, I was incredibly lucky to have assistance from Caroline and from Noel Brown, who's another survivor. Mm-hmm. Both of them are willing to share with me very intimate details of their lives. And we must not forget that that is what survivors have to do in order to make the points that they need to make about how their testimony was disregarded in the report. Caroline's evidence or testimony, it's not evidence, obviously, mm-hmm. we've been told it's not, but her testimony, as you will know, Damien, from reading it last night, is very eloquent, very vivid.
She wrote her testimony down, yeah. And when she went in, she also herself recorded it.
She did. She still doesn't know why she did that, but she did.
Yeah, and then when she matched that against what was in the final report.
I did that.
You did that.
I mean, one of the things we have to remember as well is all of this is extremely traumatising for survivors. It was hard enough to live through what they lived through in the first place. They all went in good faith to this mm-hmm. commission to tell very difficult stories on the understanding that these were going to be treated respectfully and that they would be transcribed and put into an archive and a contribution to 20th century Irish history. So you can imagine they're just stress and re-traumatisation when they discover that is not what happened.
And in fairness, though, at the same time, though, they were treated on a personal level very well when they did give their testimony. Am I right in saying that?
Well, the ones that I've spoken to have differing opinions on that. Some say yes, very sympathetic hearings. Caroline said so. Others felt that they were not treated so well. So, I mean, everyone's going to be different. Part of the problem may be that the people who were conducting the interviews at the confidential committee didn't have any training in dealing with traumatised victims, which is an important part of doing any kind of stuff like this, and also didn't have any training in oral history, which would have given them a sense of how to approach these matters in a very professional sort of way.
Okay, we might come back to that a little bit later on, but just back once again to the discrepancies that you discovered in your investigation, and back to Caroline and to Noel and indeed to Annette later, who you refer to in your essay as well. Explain, for example, how deep these discrepancies were.
Well, in the case of Caroline O'Connor, we have what amounts to about a 6-page vivid testimony, which she wrote down. She gave a copy of that to the commission and she read it out during the course of her session with them. She spent just over an hour speaking to the confidential committee. As you've just said, she had the brilliant inspiration to tape that herself. So I was able to listen to that tape and then identify Caroline in the confidential committee report, where everything is anonymized, so you don't get the details of what institution people were in or any allegations about any individuals. Fair enough. That would require them to be able to comment on it. So those 6 pages of vivid testimony, that hour-long discussion that she had with the confidential committee, is reduced to 2 paragraphs and 3 quotes. The 3 quotes allegedly come from her own words. 1 quote is accurate. 1 is entirely made up. It does not exist either in her own testimony or in the tape that was made. And the 3rd is botched. She's misquoted and it makes something very serious in her life sound grotesque in a way that it was not. So what does that tell us? It tells us that, yes, they made a tape. They told her they would make a tape. They never said nothing about destroying the tape, by the way, after the event, which is, of course, what happened. Did they listen to the tape when they were coming to the point of trying to reduce this material down into a size for their confidential committee? It would seem they didn't. They were taking notes. Were those notes impressionistic notes, or were they made by a stenographer who knew shorthand? I mean, we shouldn't have to go into all of this detail, but it's still a mystery how survivors could be so misquoted and misrepresented in the confidential committee, and primarily so reduced to paragraphs from all of that wonderful information.
But like, there were over 600 witnesses who gave evidence, a testimony of their experiences. So if you were to average them out at six pages each or an hour each, you couldn't obviously, you know, word for word, put that all into a report. So what I'm wondering is the testimony in its collective, does it take from the actual thrust of the final report when you take all of the testimonies together, even if there are paragraphs here and quotes here and there? Do you think that it takes from the overall thrust and the final report?
Well,
and
the fact is that the Commission decided itself not to include it. This is the main issue here. This is the real problem. The Commission, by the admission of Professor Mary Daly, who appeared at a seminar in Oxford last week, did not include the 550 testimonies to the Confidential Committee as part of their final report. And those testimonies did not inform their conclusions. That is critical here, because some of their conclusions were that there was no evidence of physical abuse in the mother and baby homes, no evidence of forced adoption, that the church and state were not the main perpetrators.
Yeah, it was family
abuse,
members and fathers.
Family members and fathers, which goes against every idea of historiography we have for the 20th century.
They were complicit, but probably not the main
not the main drivers.
Yes.
I mean, where did families get these ideas from in the first place? But the point I'm trying to make is the Commission left out the testimony of 550 people. There were 60 others who spoke to the investigative committee, which they did apparently take into account, or say they did. We are now missing a huge chunk of what should have had a bearing on the conclusions and recommendations of this commission. They are not there. That is serious.
The commission will say, and I think Mary Daly said that at Oxford last week. First of all, I'll ask you about her appearance at that academic online webinar last week, because they have been invited to the Joint Oireachtas Committee to appear in front of them, and they have declined so far. Now, they can't be made appear. Nobody can be made appear in front of a Joint Oireachtas Committee. But so far, they've declined the invitation. So they have not spoke publicly about the report since it was published until last week. How did you feel about that?
I felt it was peculiar. I think everyone felt it was peculiar. I think Professor Daly thought she was talking in a very enclosed environment to postgraduate students in the Department of History in Oxford. Mm. It didn't occur, I think, to her that survivors would find a way to be included on that. I mean, of course, they couldn't have been there if it was a person-to-person event where you usually have about 25 people sitting around a table at that. But Zoom has changed everything. And it was taken advantage of, in my view, brilliantly by some survivors who managed to get in on the call. Now, of course, they couldn't ask questions, but they could put questions into the chat box, and did put many questions, some of which were put to Professor Daly. But it's remarkable when you compare this commission to other previous ones that the commission has decided not to give a press conference when the report was published, not to launch it and own it themselves as their commission's report.
Yeah.
And to take questions from journalists and from survivors, as Sean Ryan did back in the day when he published the report on industrial schools, as Martin McAleese did. Whatever the shortcomings of these reports, their authors owned them and came out and answered questions, legitimate questions about them. That has so far failed to happen with these commissioners, and it is mysterious. One would think after producing 3,000 pages, 5 years of work, they would want to come out and defend what they have written and their conclusions.
Yeah. And one
but
point
it's become incredibly difficult now to do so, obviously.
And I suppose in a roundabout way, I obviously wasn't on that webinar, but I'm reading the quotes and I get the impression that what Mary Daly said at that Oxford conference was, look, we were very much constrained by the terms of reference, number one, alongside legal threats as well, which influenced maybe how the final report was actually presented. Do you accept that?
Not necessarily. I mean, their terms of reference do include the possibility of them taking into account the confidential committee testimony in reaching their final conclusions. They made the choice not to do that. Mary Daly said in that seminar in Oxford that she considered it to be not a wise idea to have run these two committees side by side, the investigative committee and the confidential committee. Well, if she thought that, why didn't she go back to government and say we have a problem with our terms of reference or with the structure of how this is going to proceed?
Do you think that those two, the two strands to the investigation and the commission, the confidential and then the judicial one, the reason for the confidential one was it would attract survivors to speak to them in confidence, survivors who up until this point had never informed anybody of their past and maybe were married with children now that knew nothing about their past and that they may not have been able to garner the evidence from them in a situation where they could have been cross-examined.
That's a very fair point. But the other point is that many people who went to the confidential committee desperately wanted to speak to the investigative committee and were not allowed to do so. So fine.
How were the people that spoke to the investigative committee, how were they chosen?
We don't know. We actually don't know.
How many of them were there?
64. I think 19 applied directly to go there. Now, I'm not an expert on this.
Sure.
I haven't gone right through it. But I did count in the report the number of survivors they mention from the different institutions.
And was the evidence gathered from the investigative part of the commission, did that form the main body of the report, whereas the 550 people who spoke to the confidential side of the commission, was their evidence disproportionate in the final report?
It wasn't there at all. That's the point. The evidence from the confidential committee remains in a bubble to one side. It does not inform the conclusions.
At all?
And we've been told that by a commissioner.
So there's 64 people who spoke to the investigative commission and whose testimony was recorded. The report is based on their testimony, which is it representative only of what they said, or does it give a proper representation of the 57,000 women or 56,000 women and 57,000 children that went through these mother and baby homes?
Ask yourself, how could it?
Yeah.
It's also that the other sorts of material, that, and some of which is really valuable, a lot of the archival material that the commission was able to access, particularly the records of the religious congregations, which, by the way, should be open to the public. They operated like an arm of the state. It would be wonderful if those records could be made available to survivors and to scholars to research them. That's all there too. People who worked in the institutions were also interviewed by the commission, members of the religious orders, all sorts of other people. The problem is that the main body, the overwhelming body of testimony provided to this commission by 550 people was effectively ignored.
Judge Yvonne Murphy, who's chairperson of the commission, she wrote to Minister for Children, Equality and Disability, Roderick O'Gorman, obviously since the report was published. I don't think this letter has come in the last week, but it's an interesting, I was just reading through it. And just one point, and I'll put it to you. The commission strongly rejects any suggestion that the final report is inaccurate. The interviewers and note takers are all professional people, and then in commas, the two committee members are lawyers and three of the four note takers are lawyers with considerable experience in interviewing and making written reports. That's very strong rebuttal of any suggestion that there was a kind of a clunky style to the final report.
Well, they may have been lawyers. Our learned friends are, of course, very experienced people in all kinds of ways. They may be used to interviewing people and writing reports, but those are legal interviews. But they had no training in how to deal with people who were telling very traumatic stories to them. And they certainly had no training in oral history and how to conduct those kind of interviews properly. So, yes, they were lawyers. Grand, great. It didn't meet the case. And in fact, it doesn't matter, because whatever we say about the professionalism or otherwise of the people who conducted the interviews, the end result is to mangle, misquote and misrepresent at least two or three of the testimonies that we know about that went to the confidential committee. Now, the miraculous outcome of all of this is, despite the fact that the commission destroyed the original tapes made by the confidential committee, 550 people's tapes, the backup tapes are discovered to be in existence and
how
still
important
viable.
Are they?
They are hugely important. And they are now safe and cannot be destroyed. And I know that that letter from Judge Murphy makes the very strong case that people were assured of confidentiality, and that's the reason these tapes had to be destroyed. Mm-hmm. However, they didn't tell anybody that in the literature they sent out to them when they were coming to the confidential committee or from the tapes that I have heard, where they go in to have the actual interview.
Well, Judge Murphy says the witness was advised that the recording would be destroyed and would not be retained by the commission, and as it was merely an aid that could be referenced if necessary in the preparation of the final report. Consent was obtained and freely given to the use of the audio device, that was the little dictaphone that was used, and to the destruction of the record when no longer needed. Not one of the 550 people interviewed objected to being recorded or to the intention to destroy the recording.
Nobody objected to being recorded, fair enough, but they weren't told the tapes were going to be destroyed. As far as we know, from the tapes, I've heard two tapes now, in neither case is the witness told that these tapes are going to be destroyed. They're asked, will they agree to have the thing taped as an aid to accuracy for the report? I mean, I quote it in the piece for Caroline. Yeah. But they're not told the tapes are going to be destroyed. That was kept a secret. Now, if they can prove, because they still have the backup tapes, that a large number of people were told this, despite the fact that we have two who were not, then we'll have to look at it again. There's also the case that there will be people who would like to have their tapes destroyed for the reasons outlined by Judge Murphy. Again, what we go back to here is, could you please consult the survivors? Could you ask them what it is they would like? A lot of people who went to the confidential committee wanted to do it in public, wanted to speak publicly about their experiences and to be named in the report, and that was turned down. But there is a way to preserve a really wonderful, important, significant, historic archive of these testimonies while acceding to the wishes of any survivors who want their tapes destroyed.
Well, no, you see, we move on now to the redress scheme, and the minister, I think, has made, the Minister O'Gorman has kind of said, well, look, we can't redo this report now because the redress scheme is linked to the evidence in the report. You're shaking your head there.
It's not. I mean, I'm not a lawyer, you know, not one of those very learned people. But I know people who are lawyers, and I've talked to a few of them over the past few days, and they are absolutely at one in believing that the redress scheme is completely separate to the recommendations of the commission.
So what should happen to the recommendations of the commission and to the final report?
I think, what survivors want, and this is what matters, not what I want. Survivors want the report repudiated, and I can see why they do. I would say that the two main issues of contention are the conclusions that the commission reached about no abuse, no forced adoption, church and state not being ultimately responsible for any of this, plus the recommendations, like the recommendation, for example, that no one who went into a mother and baby home after 1973 should get redress because it's a magical date where suddenly the unmarried mother's allowance is introduced. Nobody knew about it for a long time after that. So cop on basically there. So, I mean, if it were possible to pick and choose the good recommendations from the report, and there's no reason why the government shouldn't do that, actually. They've already said they're going to ignore that recommendation because there was such an outcry from survivors. So they're already saying, yes, there are things we can repudiate. The conclusions and recommendations are one part of it. The other thing is the confidential committee and what was egregiously done to the testimony of survivors there. And again, that because the tapes do survive wonderfully, a proper archive can be created of those.
Okay.
With permission from the survivors.
With permission from survivors. We didn't get to your piece in relation to Annette McKay giving testimony about her mother, Margaret, and how her evidence was totally misrepresentative. But it's in the Dublin Review, which I think is free to air, as we'd say. People can go online and read your report. It's fascinating stuff. Well done on it. We have made efforts to contact members of the Commission, and we would, of course, welcome their input on the programme at any stage. They're free to contact us and, explain a lot of the questions or answer a lot of the questions that you've put. But Katrina Crowe, thank you very much indeed for joining us on the programme this morning. It's just gone 11 o'clock and we go to the newsroom. And Brian Jennings.